Good afternoon. This is the Chorus Call conference operator. Welcome, and thank you for joining the Recordati preliminary full year 2020 results conference call. As a reminder, all participants are in listen-only mode. After the presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Should anyone need assistance during the conference call, they may signal an operator by pressing star and zero on their telephone. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Federica De Medici, Investor Relations and Corporate Communications. Please go ahead, madam.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for attending the Recordati conference call today. I am pleased to be here on this call by our CEO, Andrea Recordati, and Luigi La Corte, our CFO, that will be presenting our 2020 preliminary full year results and 2021 targets. They will be running you through the presentation. As usual, the set of slides is available on our website under the investor section. After that, we will open up for a Q&A, and I will now leave the floor to Andrea. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Federica. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining our 2020 results, preliminary results conference call and the 2021 targets same conference call. I would like to start by saying that I think that Recordati has delivered a resilient performance despite the challenging condition in an unprecedented environment, with revenue slightly down by 2.2% versus the previous year and/or 0.4% up at constant exchange rates. In 2020, our group faced and successfully overcome various challenges, some of which were expected, such as the loss of a marketing exclusivity for two corporate products and the entry of a new drug competing with Panhematin in the U.S., whilst others emerged during the year at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. The decline in the specialty care primary care reflects the loss of exclusivity of Silodosin in quarter one and Pitavastatin in quarter three. Strong FX headwinds, especially on the Turkish lira and the ruble, Russian ruble, and the COVID-19 effect on key market segments, particularly on the cough and cold and products linked to hospital procedures and more discretionary items, with products for chronic therapies holding up better, as you will see in more detail later in the call. The growth of the activities dedicated to the treatment of rare diseases was strong, recording an increase of 27.9%. Now, this business segment represents 22% of total revenues. Signifor and Signifor LAR reported double digits in market growth, and we're very happy with Isturisa's launch uptake to date and the initial 12 million sales we booked in 2020. The U.S. business was further strengthened with strong initial uptake of Cystadrops following its launch in Q4, and also with a carbaglutinin indication for organic acidemia, which was approved by the FDA in January 2021. Despite pressure on top line, we were able to deliver solid operative performance. EBITDA growth was up 4.7% to 569.3 million, or 39.3% of sales, significantly above last year. Adjusted net income at 410.4 million, which was up 7.3% versus 2019 and equals 28.3% of sales from the 25.8% last year. The group continues to deliver a strong cash generation of around 360 million before milestones, net share purchases, and dividends distributed. We have also further reinforced our portfolio, specifically in support of our specialty and primary care business through new licensing agreements. The license agreement with ARS Pharmaceuticals for ARS-1 is such an example, and also obviously the just announced agreement for the licensing in of Eligard in Europe, Turkey, Russia, and other countries from Tolmar. Before handing over to Luigi La Corte, who will provide more detail on our financial performance, let me provide some more updates on our endocrinology portfolio and some details on the Eligard agreement. If you could please switch to the next page. Regarding the endocrinology franchise, the commercialization of Signifor and Signifor LAR is on track, recording net revenue of 67 million euros. The transfer of distribution from Novartis is now completed, Major EU market MA transfers were completed during June and July, and the smaller CEE markets have took place during Q4 of last year. We have new patient acquisitions across all approved indications, and Signifor grew double digits in in-market sales compared to 2019. Moving to Isturisa, the launch sequence was successfully initiated in the US and parts of the EU, despite the many challenges posed by the COVID-19 pandemic, which, as you can surely appreciate, had quite an impact on the uptake of a launch product. We are satisfied with the early performance of Isturisa in this market, which is in line with our expectations, contributing net revenues of around 12 million euros, mainly in the US and France. We have strong support from top KOLs and patient organizations. The regulatory process started in March with a new drug application in Japan is on track, and we are expecting to launch in the second half of 2021. Based on what we see so far, we confirm our longer-term focus for Isturisa, therefore to achieve a leading market share with peak year sales estimated between 300 and 350 million euros, and potential further upside from the expansion of the indication to Cushing syndrome in the US and through our geo-expansion strategy in new territories. Now let's move to our latest business development deal finalized in January 2021 with Tolmar International LTD. Last month, we announced the closing of a license supply agreement with Tolmar International LTD to commercialize Eligard, leuprolidine acetate, in Europe, Turkey, Russia, and other countries. Eligard is a marketed medicinal product for the treatment of hormone-dependent advanced prostate cancer. The agreement provides us with a new product that strengthens our presence in the urological area and fits very well with our geographical footprint. Eligard is a very well-established medication in a slightly growing market, which is worth about $1 billion, according to IMS in Europe, referring to 2019 sales, half of which is represented by leuprolidine-based products. Among this product category, Eligard has around 20% market share. Annual revenues in recent years were around 100 million. Under the terms of the agreement, we will have economic benefits from the 1st of January 2021. Reported net revenue in 2021 will depend on the exact timing of transfer of sales and distribution market by market. So for our estimation for 2021, net revenue is around above 70 million euros, with an EBITDA contribution of around 20 million. We paid an upfront cash consideration of 35 million, plus milestones up to a total of 105 million, plus royalties on sales. Milestones are linked to a submission of a regulatory filing and subsequent approval of a new device, which will be easier to handle and is currently under development. 35 million euros first regulatory milestones is expected in Q4 2021. Linked to the regulatory variation, which is expected to be submitted by the 31st of October 2021. So this, at this point, I will leave the floor to Luigi to take you through in more detail on our 2020 results. Thank you.
So thank you, Andrea, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. So I'll start, as usual, by giving a little bit more granularity on our sales performance, and starting with our sales of our key corporate products, which represent 69% of revenue. Zanidip, which currently remains our biggest products, with 134.6 million of revenue in 2020, finished the year flat, marginally ahead of 2019. With growth in across several markets, but notably in Italy, Germany, Poland, and Russia, offset by erosion in France due to new measures introduced at the beginning of 2020, famous Article 66, which we've mentioned a few times over past quarters, and also due to the effect of currency changes, particularly impacting Turkey and international markets. 40% roughly of Zanidip sales are to our international affiliates. The Article 66 measures in France also accounted for most of the decline in the combination product Zanipress. which is declining by close to 18% for the year. Our metoprolol franchise, which is now our second biggest franchise for the group, grew nicely at 7.5% with total revenue of 105.7 million, with broad-based growth, particularly strong in Central and Eastern Europe, and particularly in those markets where we have set up a direct selling organization most recently. Urorec reflects clearly the impact of loss of exclusivity. You'll recall generic entered majority of markets in February of 2020, impacting particularly revenue in Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Germany. In fact, in most of the markets, Urorec sales held up better than expected. In fact, erosion was somewhat lower than we had anticipated at the beginning of the year. Some of that, unfortunately, offset by, measures favoring dispensing of generics in France issued in early 2020. Notably, Urorec continued to grow in markets where generics have not entered, Turkey, Greece, and Switzerland in particular. Similarly, Basel, revenue down by 1.8% at close to 53 million, reflects loss of exclusivity starting in August, which offset the growth that we saw in the first part of the year for pitavastatin. Again, here, the product still growing in markets where generics, where we don't expect generics, mainly Turkey, Greece, and Switzerland. Other corporate products of 270 million roughly is where, as we commented in previous calls, we saw the brunt of the impact of the COVID-19 restrictions. Other corporate products includes OTC, as you will recall. And here we've seen, and we commented before, a significant impact in our cough and cold franchises, which is particularly strong in Russia and other markets in Central and Eastern Europe, impacting sales of Isofra and Polydexa, and equally pandemic restrictions also impacting the sales of anti-infectives products in general. In many cases across Europe, we saw restrictions and reductions, significant reductions in elective hospital procedures, which impacted sales of Citrafleet and the Nemacazin in Spain and Portugal, and generally a lower consumption of over-the-counter drugs and more discretionary medications. Within corporate products, to note the good growth of Regila, up more than 60% versus previous year, and growth also of some of our key products within OTC, Procto-Glyvenol and Casenlax in particular. Finally, drugs for rare diseases were up significantly with growth of close to 28%. They now represent close to 22% of revenue. Majority of the growth being driven clearly by our endocrinology franchise and Signifor in particular, which added 57 million euros to revenue, which we already recorded in Q4 of last year, and Isturisa contributed, as Andrea mentioned, 12 million euros of revenue. Noteworthy, we saw growth during the year also on Carbaglue, Cystadan, Sister Drops, Ledaga, and Juxtapid, so amongst the several of our product franchises, which offset the erosion in the U.S. On Panimetin following the launch of a competitor. We're pleased to see that following a somewhat sharper than expected decline over the April to June month, at the peak of the restrictions, we have seen sales stabilize, and with a degree of erosion, which is now more in line with our expectations as patients flow readjusted to the COVID restrictions. On the next slide, on slide six, you'll see we always show the composition of our portfolio. As I commented, rare diseases now represent 22% of group revenue, up from 16.9% in 2019. OTC is slightly down to 18.1% from 18.6% in 19. And the incidence of local product portfolios also continues reducing and is now under 16% from 17% in 2019. Switching to slide 7 and looking at revenues for key geographies, the picture is very much consistent with one that we commented in the last quarter, and illustrates the differential impact that the pandemic has had on different parts of the portfolio and therefore also different markets. Sales in Italy were down close to 5%, reflecting generic erosion on pantoprazole and Lanto, which started in the second half of 2019, but also the loss of exclusivity of Urorec, and lower market levels for some of our OTC products and Ruflor. We did see in Italy strong performance and growth of more chronic medications, namely Cardicor, Zanidip, and Obregila, and also clearly a strong contribution of the rare disease portfolio, offsetting some of those pressures from the COVID restrictions. France down by 8.4%, and this was one of the painful notes of 2020, as we've commented throughout the year, with measures introduced in January of 2020, which favored the dispensing of generic medicines. This impacted both our lercanidipine and combination sales, and particularly impacted Urorec revenue upon generic entry, where erosion was higher than expected. All of this partly offset by what we saw being a very strong growth of rare diseases and also of the local methadone franchise. Germany revenue held up better at minus 2.1%, with most of the decline actually being due to generic competition on tenders of Ortoton, with good growth in Germany here once again from the addition of Signifor, and also initial sales of Isturisa, which is off to a really strong start in Germany. U.S. Revenue up by 14% in local currency, or 11.8 on a reported basis, at 122.5 million euros. We did see a strengthening of the euro against the dollar in the back part of the year. Growth, as we have commented, mostly driven by the endocrinology franchise, but also good growth of Carbaglu and Sister Drops following its launch in the later part of the year. Once again, all of those more than offsetting the erosion on Panhematin. Russia, other CIS, and Ukraine, revenue of just over 100 million. These markets really saw an impact, a combined impact, both of the COVID restrictions on the cough and cold portfolio, but also of FX with FX impact in Russia in particular of 11.7%, which led to accounted for a significant part of the decline in the reported figures there. Sales in Russia, as I said before, have a significant incidence of cough and cold medications and medications for acute conditions, which were amongst the most impacted by the pandemic. We did see in the market double-digit growth in local currency on Procto-Glyvenol, Alphavit, Zanidip, Urorec, and Nivazol, which part offset that. Revenue in smaller Central and Eastern European markets and other Western European markets both grew by double digit, driven by the strong growth of Metoprolol, particularly in Poland, the Czech, Baltics, and Romania, but also good growth of Livazo and Regila in Switzerland and the Nordics. And of course, here again, the contribution of rare diseases. Revenue in Spain down by 11.5% to just under 84 million euros. Spain reflecting both the loss of exclusivity of silodosin and pitavastatin, but also, as I said, the significant impact from hospital procedures being put on hold for a large part of the year, which impacted sales of Citrafleet, which is one of our biggest franchises in the market and used for endoscopies, and Enema Kazin, and also softer market for pediatrics and probiotics products. Turkey continued to grow double-digit in local currency terms with local growth of 11.6%, but reflects a staggering 23% headwind in terms of foreign exchange with significant erosion and decline of the Turkish lira over the course of the year. Growth of the Turkish business was broad-based and really driven both by our corporate product and also the local product portfolio. Portugal revenue of 42.7, down by 3.9%, reflect very similar dynamics to the ones that I mentioned for the Spanish market, with good growth of Regila, both in the case of Portugal and Spain, partially offsetting the pressures from the loss of exclusivity on silodosin and pitavastatin. North Africa sales up by 2.3%, reflecting actually slightly down versus double-digit growth in the first part of the year, reflecting a bit of weakness of currencies against the euros in the later part of the year, and also some restrictions to exports towards some markets in North Africa in Q4. And finally, other international sales of just over 200 million, broadly flat with 2019. With growth of rare diseases, in particular in MENA and Mexico, offset by impact of foreign currencies, weakness against the euro, and also some discontinuation of licenses for markets where we've taken back distribution of our products over the course of 2019. On slide 8, once again, the composition of revenue by key geography, very much unchanged, very similar to the snapshot last year, and just confirming the diversified footprint of the group, which we believe this year allowed us to to deliver the kind of solid and resilient performance that Andrea alluded to, with revenue slightly down but plus 0.4% at a constant exchange rate basis. Switching over to slide 9 and looking at the P&L, the slight decline on the revenue line is, as you see, almost fully offset already at the gross profit level, thanks to improvement in gross margin to 71.9% of sales, driven mostly by the shifting mix of our portfolio towards rare diseases. SG&A at 421.9 million is down versus 19, reflecting lower level of activity spend in the face of COVID. We estimate we had for roughly 35 million of savings, which we achieved this year versus 2019 to offset the impact on the top line, particularly on selling costs, which are around 24.1% of sales, with G&A expenditure of 5% of sales, broadly flat with 2019. R&D expenses are up by 12.8% at just over 10% of revenue, with the majority of the increase being driven by the additional amortization charges arising from the new products that we acquired from Novartis, and also from some of the studies that we inherited. We do expect R&D expenses as percent of revenue to stay broadly at this level as we go into 2021. Other expenses of 4.9 million reflect mostly the non-recurring costs of roughly 6 million euros, which we had in 2020, being mostly the COVID-19-related donations, and also include 0.5 million of non-recurring costs linked to the reverse merger transaction, which we announced earlier in the year. That leads to an operating income of 469 million, 32.4%, and slightly above prior year, an EBITDA of 569.3 million, or 39.3% of sales, up 4.7% versus 2019, which once again we believe is very strong performance in a challenging environment. And as we've commented in the past, the difference in growth rates between EBITDA and operating income being driven by the increased amortization year on year, and also the non-recurring costs which are adjusted in EBITDA, but not at an operating income level. Net income of 355 million, down 3.8%, but the reduction really due to the exceptional and non-recurring benefit of tax benefit of 27 million related to patent box linked to prior years, which we recorded at the end of 2019. We did have a small positive non-recurring tax item of 2 million in 2020. Adjusting for these, growth of net income would be 3.2%. And adjusted net income at 410 million is up 7.3% relative to 2019. This is on the back of the strong operating performance, but also thanks to lower financing charges. This is whilst currency movements did put, particularly in the back end of the year, a bit of pressures on our operating margins, they did have a positive impact, which is accounted for in financial expenses, due principally to the positive impact these had on transactions no longer treated as hedges, which recorded in the first half of the year and which were closed in April. and also to some exchange rate gains on settlement of currency transactions. Switching to slide 10, clearly rare diseases account for a growing share of both revenue and operating results, over 25% of both EBIT and EBITDA is contributed from our rare disease business, with margins that clearly in 2020 reflecting also a little bit the launch investments behind this Isturisa. And noteworthy, though, specialty and primary care business, despite the LOEs and COVID impact, delivered on an absolute basis operating results which were almost in line with 2019, which again, once again, we believe is a very resilient and solid performance. Last from my side, net financial position, with net debt on slide 11, net debt of just under 866 million, down versus 902.7 million at the end of 19. This equates to roughly 1.5 times EBITDA, which is in line with where we said we would be in our plan assumptions, and really reflect the strong underlying cash flow performance of the group. Over the course of 2020, we paid $90 million US dollars of milestones to Novartis for the Endo franchise transaction, 50 million euros to Ars Pharmaceuticals for the rights to ARS-1, dividends of 212.5 million, and had net share repurchases of 12.2 million, with therefore an underlying cash generation of 360 million euros approximately, which remains in line with a track record of delivering cash at roughly 100% of net income. And with that, I will hand over to Andrea to talk about the expectations for 2021.
Thank you very much, Luigi. So if you can please turn to page 12 of the presentation. So the assumptions behind our 21 targets are summarized in the slide. Regarding the 2021 guidance, assuming, and this is very important, assuming a gradual recovery of our reference markets after the COVID-19, we expect this to occur in the second half of 2021. So we still expect, obviously, some degree of uncertainty and volatility in the markets until the end of the first half. And obviously, also despite the continued adverse effects headwinds of roughly minus 2%, we expect to achieve net revenue growth of 10% in 2021. Our key assumptions are the following. So specialty and primary care returning to low single-digit organic growth following silodosin and pitavastatin loss of exclusivity in 2020, and an assumed return to more normal market conditions, like I said, in the second half of the year. Of course, please keep in mind that the Q1 of 2020 was mostly free of COVID impact, and in fact reflected overstocking by wholesalers, and was only partially affected by the loss of exclusivity impact on silodosin. We expect Eligard revenues of around 70 million, or over 70 million, I should say, subject to the exact timing of in-market distribution as already highlighted. High double-digit growth of the rare disease business, driven by continued strong uptake of the Endo franchise. Signifying in Isturisa, net revenue is expected to be around 120 to 140 million euros over a year, with further growth also coming from sister drops, Ledaga, Juxtapid, offsetting the Panhematin decline in the US. We expect R&D costs to remain around 10% of revenue, reflecting the incremental MSL to support the Endo franchise and the amortization charges related to the recent asset acquisitions. Assuming partial normalization of activities post-COVID-19, EBITDA margin will be above 38%, reflecting as well the transition costs on Eligard. Financing costs of around 22 to 24 million are expected, with no FX gains losses assumed on this item. Tax rate to be around 20%, reflecting also 12.9 million non-recurring actual benefit from the reverse merger transaction. To be noted that no new undisclosed acquisitions or business development initiatives are included in our 2021 targets. And last but not least, dividend payout policy is confirmed at 60% of total net income. To complete, switch to the last slide of the presentation, slide 13, which sums up the 2021 targets. So we expect to have revenues ranging from 1.570 billion to 1.620 billion. EBITDA in a range that goes from 600 to 620 million. And adjusted net income of between 420 and 440 million. As previously mentioned, we also plan to provide an update to our 3-year business plan in May. So this brings us to the end of our presentation, and I think we can, at this point, move to the Q&A. Thank you.
Okay. We are now ready to take a question.
All right, perfect. Excuse me, this is the Chorus Call conference operator. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on their touchtone telephone. To remove yourself from the question queue, please press star and two. Please pick up the receiver when asking questions. Anyone who has a question may press star and one at this time. The first question is from James Vane-Tempest from Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my questions. I'll start off with two, and I'll have a follow-up if I may. Just on the guidance, the consolidated guidance, the organic growth of around 10%, and thank you for the detail on the slide, but I'm just curious, what does this assume for Livazo and Eurorec? Are these losing exclusivity this year? And then the second is just on EBITDA guidance. At least sort of looking what this might be ex the Eligard and Isturiza, is this basically declining to flat in 2021? And if so, what's driving that? Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, James. So thanks for the question. So first of all, just to be clear, the overall revenue growth, which is quoted on slide 12 of 10%, is the total revenue growth, which does reflect, though, a sort of 2% FX. You will see underneath it that we also mentioned the Eligard revenue. So just to be clear, overall revenue growth of around 10% is a total growth, and it's, you know, consistent with the range that we've provided for total revenue. You asked about Silodosin and Pitavastatin further erosion next year. I would assume an extra 10 million for both. With the Silodosin obviously being a larger product, but having gone generic in the early part of the year. With regards to Eligard, we are expecting a EBITDA contribution this year of around 20 million euros, which reflects, you know, this being first year, also some transition cost. I'm not going to give sort of a detailed EBITDA number for Endo. So hopefully that gives at least a sort of answer to most of your question.
Thank you. And then just the follow-ups, the 35 million euros of SG&A savings from COVID, how much of that is expected to return as normal activities resume? And does your guidance assume any further price erosion in Europe, please?
I'll answer this one, James. So we expect basically 50% of operational savings that we delivered in 2020 that will be retained in 2021.
Thank you.
The next question is from Martino De Ambroggi with Equita. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. My first question is on the R&D, because in 2020 was 10% of sales, mainly because of lower sales. So I suppose the total amount was more or less in line with your expectation. You are guiding for another 10% in 2021, which is a quite high level compared to the past few years. Never achieved 10% for many, many years. So should we take this as a normal level going forward, or is it because of specific studies you are financing right now?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Martino. I mean, the growth also in sort of 2021 will be, you know, in part the additional amortization that comes from the Eligard deal. We're assuming 20-year sort of amortization and assuming that on both the upfront and the additional milestone, which will be paid, we assume, over the course of 2021. There is a little bit of additional investment behind the Endo franchise, but the majority really is the amortization, which is good in that. But again, the forecast is for it to remain sort of flat in terms of percent of revenue. There is a little bit of studies, as we said, that sort of are continuing on the Endo portfolio as well, and we do have some of our programs which are progressing, MT8 in particular. But again, the majority of it is amortization increase.
Okay, so we can take 10% as an indication also going forward, or is probably declining?
We're not providing sort of an updated sort of plan today, but I mean, it'll depend a little bit also on the type of deals that we may do in the future, as always, which is, you know, would they come with significant, if it were to be an M&A transaction with significant part of the purchase price allocated to goodwill, we won't have any amortization, we won't have any sort of increase in R&D. If it's intangible, specific asset, then, which is why we've sort of kind of shifted the emphasis on EBITDA and adjusting an income, which adjusts for amortization, if that makes sense.
Okay, thank you. The second question is on the 2021 guidance. In the past, you provided guidance including acquisitions. I know I'm not asking you anything because it's impossible to predict, but do you feel confident to reiterate the guidance including acquisitions? Because I ask you because last year I remember the M&A processes were a little bit slowed down because of the COVID pandemic and so on. So probably, I don't know, maybe you are more confident today in either new in-licensed drugs or acquisitions. So just your feeling.
Well, I mean, I'll answer this. I mean, in 2020, we delivered on the acquisition side because, as you know, acquisition slash business development, obviously, I'm talking about Eligard, which is a substantial business development initiative for Recordati and aimed at reinforcing our SPC business. There was a slowdown, but we did not perceive such a slowdown in 2020 due to the COVID pandemic, honestly. So things on the business development M&A kind of front did progress. We looked at various opportunities, but clearly, you know, not all opportunities pan out for a variety of reasons, and they're all different from one another. We don't give guidance in our yearly targets. We give guidance in our three-year plan targets. We've always done this in the past, and we will keep on doing this. So obviously, we will build in some sort of objective on M&A targets in our business plan, which we will present in May. Clearly, we continue scouting. You know, we have a very, very kind of, you know, focused and intensive scouting activity, both in SPC and rare diseases. And honestly, we're not seeing any shortage of opportunities. So obviously, the objective is to deliver also this year. But as I said, you cannot kind of, you know, celebrate until you have the cat in the bag. So
yes.
We'll give you some more outlook on this for in the three-year plan.
Sorry, one follow-up. I sort of just realized that I hadn't fully addressed. I think there was a third element to earlier question from James around profit evolution. As implied in the guidance for 2021 ex the Eligard portion. Let's just don't forget in the context, we are still factoring in our guidance 2% headwind of FX versus sort of 2.6% of this year. We are anticipating, and I think this is consistent across the sector, COVID still to impact to some extent the first half of the year, and obviously, as I said, the sort of detail of the loss of exclusivity impact on Cilostazol and Pitavastatin. So clearly, there's still a little bit of headwind from that as we go into 2021. Operator, next question.
Yeah, if I may, am I still online? No. Hello?
Yeah, you are.
Okay, sorry. Just the very last question on Signifor is tourism. Could you provide a split between the two like last year? Just to understand that Japan will be launched in the second half, but probably this year it doesn't represent a significant contribution. And for Eligard, is it possible to have a peak sales potential, or 100 million is the reference point for the long term?
Okay, let me answer this. Regarding the first question of a split of our guidance of 120 to 140 million for the end of franchise, we will not be providing a product split of the 2021 estimate. We have given a split of the 2020 results and an indication of the 2020 growth rates we've seen so far on Signifor versus sales achieved in 2019. Clearly, it's important to say that we also expect this tourism to account for a significant part of the growth in 2021. Japan, yes, like you correctly said, is not going to be a major contributor in 2021, so no, I will confirm that. And regarding Eligard, yes, for the moment, I think we will confirm that, the 100 million sales, full-year sales that we mentioned before, starting from 2022.
Thank you very much.
The next question is from Casey Arikatla from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my questions. I have a few modeling ones, please, and one big picture question. On the modeling ones, if is the 13 million tax benefit, the non-recurring one that you have mentioned, is that part of your adjusted net income guidance or not, please? And second one, if I look at the M&A environment and the appetite from your side to do M&A, is it fair to say that we can expect some M&A in this year beyond what you have announced, or is that not likely to be the case? And the third one on Eligard, you've mentioned 70 million in sales and 20 million in EBITDA. Assuming you get the marketing rights all transferred, that becomes 100 million in sales. What would be the right EBITDA number, please? Is that still 20 million? Thank you.
Hi, Kisti. Thanks for the question. So first of all, in terms of adjusted net income guidance, so just to be clear, the 27 million non-recurring one-off was the sort of 2019 item, just to be clear. We have included in our guidance, as you know, adjusted net income does not include non-recurring items. So we've mentioned it sort of, we've reminded you of the non-recurring benefit from the reverse merger, so that if you're wanting to model net income, that we have that additional benefit, which doesn't go into adjusted net income. So so again, the 12.9 million non-recurring tax benefit from the reverse merger would not be included, because it would be adjusted in the guidance that we have provided. I'll take the Eligard one. Expectations on EBITDA thereafter, I think you should model on the basis of a normal SPC level margins. Whether or not, how quickly we get to that, whether that's already 2022, we'll see, and we'll provide an update when we do the 3-year plan. But the number that we're quoting for this year is very much reflective of transition. For M&A in terms of expectations for this year, I mean, all I can say is M&A remains an integral part of the strategy.
I replied to that question before. I mean, it remains an integral part of our business development activity in, let's say, growth strategy. As I said, there's no shortage of opportunities that we're seeing. But again, you know, until they materialize, it's difficult to make any predictions. And we're not going to give, like, we're never giving targets for M&A for 1 year targets. We will give you an outlook on what we expect for the 3-year plan.
And so just to be clear, the targets we've read out do not include further M&A.
That was mentioned in the presentation.
Thank you.
The next question is from Joe Walton with Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Just a few, please. On Isturisa, you've told us that you're off to a great start in Germany. I wonder if you could just help us with the landscape in the rest of Europe, where you've got pricing, where you've got reimbursement, whether that reimbursement level that you're getting in other countries is coming in at the same level. I mean, in Germany, you can sort of choose your level, can't you, for at least a year or so. So just give us a little bit more of the flavor of the landscape, please, for Isturisa in Europe. A second question would be the trough level that we could get down to for Livaso and Urorec. Now, I know they're not your products like Zanidip, but Zanidip, years past patent expiry, is still an incredibly important driver for you. I'm just wondering whether the 10 million of erosion that you talk about for this year is where new countries are getting some generics, or whether you feel that that is continued erosions. I'm just trying to get at the sort of level that we should be thinking of going forwards with the level of support. And I'm thinking particularly because you did so well with Seloken, up 8%. Again, is Seloken now, do you think, at a stable level? Or do you think that you'll be able to get some further growth from that product as you move it into some of your more peripheral markets? And my final question would be about the savings. Actually, no, I've got two more. I apologize. The savings from COVID. You talk about 35 million of marketing savings. How quickly do you think that you will come back to spend that again? I assume not in 2021 because you told us that COVID will keep going. For at least part of the year. But if we were to look further out, and given the fact that you've got new, more specialist products coming through, do you think we should be ramping up our SG&A? And my final question is a big picture question. You talked about the new measures that came in France last year, which eroded some of your products more than you expected because the minute there was a patent expiry, it went to full genericization. Given that European governments are going to be short of cash post-COVID, are there any other markets where you have any visibility of the same sort of let's use a true generic rather than a branded generic coming in that we might have to think about? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Joe. I'll do my best. A lot of questions there. So I'll start with the last one, and because it's a relatively straightforward one. No, we're not foreseeing a sort of significant new measures being introduced across Europe as a result of the pandemic. Yes, you know, governments are facing you know, significant budget deficits, but one, at least from our sort of vantage point, they don't seem in a hurry necessarily to claw those back, and hopefully they are working on a number of fronts in partnership with the pharmaceutical industry. And I think I've realized also the importance of a well-funded healthcare system. So I think I've mentioned in prior calls, we can mention a number of anecdotes where we see actually things going the opposite way. So, of course, it can happen, and it does happen from time to time, and it's been the history of the sector over the last 10 years, but we're not anticipating at this stage, you know, very significant pricing pressure or new generic measures across key markets. Isturisa and how it's going in Europe, first of all, my apology. I put the emphasis on Germany, and of course we're on track in Germany as well. France is right now the market where the launch is most advanced across Europe, and that's on the back of the strong early access program that was in place in the country that also benefits from a more centralized management of these patients. But both France and Germany is where we're seeing a strong initial adoption. We are anticipating Isturisa to gain reimbursement in a number of European markets over the course of the year, but it will be later in the year. It's currently, we are still in pricing negotiation discussions across France and in Italy. Germany, as you've mentioned, we are allowed to launch at our sort of set price and then initiating negotiations 1 year post. So that's still all to play out, frankly. I mean, and all I can say to that is that the product, as Andrea mentioned, has strong endorsement from KOLs. It has a strong endorsement from the European authorities themselves when confirming the orphan drug status. So we have no reason to believe we will not be getting the kind of recognition of the value of Isturisa that we think the product deserves. Livazo and Urorec, just to be clear, sort of when I said 10 million sort of further erosion, that was 10 million on each of the two. And that's really just due to it being a full-year impact more than anything. In fact, we started to see, in markets where sort of generics have entered, for example, in the case of Urorec in February, early March of 2020, we have started to see volumes stabilize. So I think those are more sort of, full-year effects rather than the reflection of significant further erosion to come on a market by market basis. Celoken was a good growth driver, strong growth driver this year. We do still see opportunity for growth, as I said, particularly in those markets, Central Eastern Europe, Nordics, Baltics, where we've set up our own direct selling operations more recently. I won't provide a sort of exact sort of number for that, but certainly we do see an opportunity there. And I think in terms of the savings on COVID, I think we've been quite consistent actually over the course of 2020 to signal that not 100% of the savings that we would be able to retain, but certainly some, we think are potentially here to stay. I think inevitably we all, and physicians, will get used to doing, particularly where spend was linked to large events and gatherings, whilst hopefully we'll return to face-to-face at some point. I don't think it'll be at the same scale as in the past. I'm sure international travel will be restricted for a while, so I would not be sort of ramping up. And again, we haven't sort of done a sort of 3-year plan update. We'll do that in May, but no, I would not be sort of foreseeing a sort of major ramp up of spend in the years to come. Hopefully, that has addressed most of your questions or all of your questions. So shout if not.
Thank you.
The next question is from Giorgio Tavolini with Intermonte. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, and thanks everyone. Thanks for taking my question. I would like to have some color on the intangible amortization In order to proper modeling the adjusted net income line for 2021, on what period do you expect to amortize the license regarding Eligard? Is it fair to assume an overall 80 million amortization of intangible assets before taxes? 65 million euros for 2021 net of tax. And the second question is on the financial cost in 2020. What is the detail on this line? And the third one is on the buffings. Are you interested in accommodating at your production plan some production for buffings by acquiring rights in sub-license in order to contribute to the speed up of the vaccine rollout? Thank you.
Simple one. If I understand correctly, you're asking if we're doing anything with our manufacturing facilities to actually participating in the manufacturing of vaccines. Huh? Is that
yes.
What I understood?
Yes.
Well,
yes,
no, the vaccines, let's say, industry is a very specific one. You need special, manufacturing facilities, which are very kind of, ad hoc and designed specifically for manufacturing of vaccines. So, no, it's not something that we would be able to set up, notwithstanding all the regulatory hurdles to approve them and so forth, and the heavy capex investment. So it's something which is completely out of our scope of business.
Okay.
Yeah. Of amortization charges for 2021, we are amortizing the Eligard upfront and first milestone over 20 years. Of course, we start amortization on Isturisa sort of on a by country basis as of the time when the product is launched in the market. You should assume an amortization absolute charge in 2021 of over 70 million euros, roughly, Giorgio. And sorry. Financial items for 2020, the gains from currency movements were in the range of, say, 6-7 million euros, to give you an indication.
Okay, thank you very much.
As a reminder, if you wish to register for a question, please press star and one on your telephone. The next question is from Isacco Brambilla with Mediobanca. Please go ahead.
Hi, good evening, everybody. Just a couple of questions from my side. The first one is on your new additions to the orphan drugs portfolio. Sister drops and second indication for Carbaglu. Can you remind us how we should look at these products if we were to rank your treatments for rare disease in terms of market opportunity? And the second question is on your cash deployment. Arguably, the large acquisition, the large license of Eligard brought an overall cash out lower than what we were expecting for acquiring 100 million euros annual turnover. How do you intend to redeploy this additional firepower which you are now available? Thanks.
Question. Thanks.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you, Zacco. So, sister drops in the US, we see opportunity, which is in terms of just to give it a scale below 20 million US dollar over time. The launch has started quite well, actually. In fact, if anything, it's ahead of our expectations. So far, so good. But that is the indication. It is a fairly, quite rare condition, so it's great news for patients, but it's clearly more limited in scale relative to some of the other more recent additions. And CarbaBlue OA, similarly, I think it will contribute to the continued growth of CarbaBlue in the U.S., but the indication is for use in acute setting, and therefore is not going to be a sort of a very material driver on its own. In terms of cash, clearly when looking at our firepower, we don't just look at the sort of cash on the balance sheet, but where we are in terms of leverage overall. And as I said, we're 1.5 times EBITDA, which is very much in line with where we said we would be. We did say when the plan was less refreshed that we would go up to a maximum of 3, but only if and when a very specific opportunity came about. And so nothing has changed really in terms of from our perspective. We did a very significant deal in 2019 with over $400 million cash outlay. We've done this one now, and of course we'll continue to scout. We're continuing discussions for same type of opportunities that we've discussed in the past, both on the SPC side and the rare disease side. So I'm not sure we see it as being in a sort of very different position in terms of cash and leverage from where we thought we were going to be. I think we're pretty much in line with where we said we would be actually from that perspective. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. Just one very brief follow-up, if I may. In terms of market multiples, have you seen any kind of change because of the healthcare emergency or nothing really material compared to the past?
No, I'd say no. We haven't seen anything.
Okay, thank you.
Market multiples, due to COVID. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you wish to register for a question, please press star and one on your telephone. The next question is a follow-up from Joe Walton with Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Just a quick one on your share buyback program. Is that purely to offset expected share issuance, or does that have some element of you thinking that the shares are particularly undervalued and you haven't got anything else that you need to spend your money on at the moment, and therefore you're making a deliberate share buyback? Many thanks.
No, thank you for the question, Joe, but it is really a technical one. We have existing stock options program in place. Our programs actually do not foresee the issuance of new shares. So the programs foresee that any exercises would be fulfilled through treasury shares, and all we're doing is making sure that we have what is required to fulfill any potential shares vesting, which either are already vested or vesting between now and May. So no, it's not because of, as I said, from our perspective, where we are in terms of net debt is exactly where we thought we would be in the plan.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, there are no more questions registered at this time.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for listening in. Take care. Be safe. And we'll speak soon. Bye-bye.